You're listening to the All Caps Podcast, episode 55 for the week of Monday, December 13th, 2010. In this episode, we discuss getting rear-ended, college degrees as receipts, the sunset of Netflix, Real Dolls, John Boner crying, Mark Wiener and Anthony Wiener, Thunderdome Combat, Tax Cuts and Eating the Rich, Robin Leach, Black Swan, Natalie Portman's Beauty, Pro Wrestling, The Bushwhackers, Homoeroticism, Jungle Bird Mating Dances, Brooklyn Brawler, Barber Beefcakes, and a whole lot more. For more information, please visit www.allcapspodcast.com.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like a keg of beer, please.
You don't say.
Yeah, how much is that?
Give me ID, sonny. You little bastard just won't give up, will you? Listen, no ID, no goddamn beer. Can't you get that through your thick skull?
Give me a keg of beer.
And these.
Caps Podcast, your source for news, politics, cultural varieties. I'm one of your hosts, Tanner Higgin, podcasting out of a desert in Southern California.
And I'm your other host, Chris View, podcasting from the frozen sub-zero life. It's tundra that is climate change to Detroit.
And we'll begin the show with a rant from Chris. You were pissed off today and chomping at the bit to get something off your chest. So what is it?
Well, there's a ton of shit pissing me off. First off, this fucking storm comes through here. Storm of the century, right? Straight out of a Stephen King novel. The fucking apocalypse is upon us here in Detroit. Blizzard-like conditions. It got to be... Well, I got rear-ended today by some jagoff who didn't speak any English. Bunch of foreigners. Perfect way to segue into a...
Foreigners can't drive.
Now, it was a stupid thing. And then, like, what happened was the person who was driving the car was actually this guy who's clearly, you know, he's here illegally. And his son.
Clearly.
I asked to see his papers, but he didn't understand what I was saying. I used one of those. God damn it. I wish I had it on tap. What's the line Indy uses in Indiana Jones and in The Last Crusade, where he says, like, no ticket or whatever, and throws the guy out the Zeppelin. That's what I should have done. Thrown the guy into a snowbank instead, though. But no, anyway, this motherfucker, his kid just got sass with me, and he's like, well, you're not calling the cops, are you? And I was like, no, I'm not calling the fucking cops. I'm calling my insurance company so I can get my fucking costs recouped after you damaged my bumper, you jackass. That's not what I want to rant about today, though. Let's talk about math standards. So this is what I was really pissed about today. Well, actually, I don't even know if I'm pissed about it. I've got an opinion, though, and this is what's happening. I go to Wayne State University here in Detroit for my grad program, and it has certain standards that you have to meet in order to either be admitted or to continue further in your journey toward your master's degree. But this also applies to students coming in for their undergrad. You have to take a math placement exam to get in. Now, what I found interesting was a lot of the universities around here actually sort of waive that math proficiency exam and allow students who, let's say, if on one of your standardized tests, like your ACTs or your SATs, if you scored a certain, if you had a certain score, they'll waive your need to take any sort of a math test. Whereas at Wayne State, they have a math test, and you cannot graduate unless you pass this test. And right now, there are 1,970 students, 1,500 students who can't graduate. Their graduation is held up because they have not finished this math test that they should have taken and by now mastered. This test, according to the faculty, or at least the administration at Wayne State, is at a high school level of math. But these people are not getting their degrees. And what they're doing, instead of placing the onus on themselves, they're blaming the university for giving a hard test. And I guess I'm kind of frustrated because I think what this plays into for me, now you can tell me if you have a different opinion. For me, it just means that people think that their degrees can be paid for and that college shouldn't be difficult, that there shouldn't be much of a challenge involved with it. And this whole leveling of the playing field, I get it to an extent. It's nice to welcome people into the hallowed halls of academia, in a sense. It's nice to be able to say, let's bring as many people under the tent of education. That way we have a highly educated citizenry. I get that. But if you can't pass a basic math test, and instead of pointing the finger at you, or perhaps even saying, you know, I never received the skill sets that they're trying to test me on. I kind of get that too. But they offer fucking tutoring. They offer, you know, these classes you can take to reach the standard that they want. And this isn't necessarily even me chastising the United States math skills, math literacy, which I could, I suppose, because we are very we're underachievers when it comes to math and sciences. But more so, I'm pissed that these people are upset at the university as opposed to looking at themselves and saying, wait, why am I not good at this? Why can't I get it? You know, there's 1,500 kids who can't graduate because of this, but there's plenty more who did graduate. 1,970 did. So over 50% of last week's graduating class passed without having to care about this math test. Now, anecdotally, I talked to Katie. She got her undergrad from Wayne State. She did have to take the test twice, but she wasn't a math student. She was in the theater. And it's not, you know, it's not one of those, it's sort of like I was with history where I needed my basic statistics course and that was it. So anyway, I wanted to bring this out because I'm frustrated that it seems like people aren't looking at themselves for where the problem is when it comes to this kind of stuff. But you might have a different opinion because you're actually involved in academia. You might even know people who write these tests. You might know a little bit more of the inside scoop. Maybe this is some sort of a way to weed out the shit and keep, you know, but if that's the case, then it's wrong of Wayne State to have allowed these people to continue ahead with a degree that they would never be able to get if they can't even pass the math test. Like, they shouldn't even be allowed to enroll for classes if they haven't finished that math test, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in that I do think that you can diagnose this culture as having a serious issue with irresponsibility, and especially the deflection of responsibility. I don't think that this is just we're getting old and starting to, you know, sort of chastise the rest of the country and its downward spiral. I really do think there's a serious problem with responsibility. I think it has to do with the way kids are brought up, mm-hmm. and certain changes in parenting that were popular in the 70s and 80s. And I think this is part of it, but it's compounded by the fact, like you aptly pointed out, that there is a transformation going on in the university system where it's being corporatized, and universities are being seen as for-profit institutions that have to have a good bottom line, and students are seen, and students see themselves as customers, which is mm-hmm. fucked up. So when they matriculate to an institution, they just see it as, well, I'm paying the money and I will get my degree because I've paid the money. There's no thought to wanting to better yourself or challenge yourself or have to meet certain standards. It's, mm-hmm. well, I paid for this. Why am I not getting what I should get? And then the blame automatically gets shifted to either poor teachers or there's something fucked up with the program in itself.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's that problem. But I'm also very aware of the way sometimes higher education can be structured that excludes people. Like in the Detroit area, you have the worst public school system in the country, probably. And part of that is awful math education, I'm certain. So you have probably a lot of people that are getting into Wayne State who have just through social inequality not been given the appropriate skills.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that portion of it, which can be really troubling, that perhaps these people are being excluded
and the problem is compounded, and actually the problem is in the public school system, not in the college system.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that college needs to have a certain standard. I mean, you absolutely have to have some sort of bar that they're reaching. Otherwise, the point of going to college is worthless, and it does just become a receipt for a payment of degree. Yeah. Now, the problem I see with this system is that it's the bad news is coming too late. So people mm-hmm. feel like, well, I earned everything else. This is keeping me behind.
I agree.
At my school, the big thing is writing. That's the problem, because there's a lot of second language learners. So writing is often the big hurdle that people have to get over. And the way it works here is you get admitted on a probationary basis. So right off the bat, you know that, well, I'm a little bit behind. I've got to improve. So then there's a system in place where there's a whole probationary writing program for probationary students, built to have them succeed and reach the standard. And they all have to take an exam that says they've reached the standard, and they all have to do it within, I think, their first 2 years.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a way better system. You come in, you know that you're behind. There's a whole institutional system in place to make sure you get to that level if you put in the effort. And then you know within your first 2 years where you're at, whereas it seems like in this system, you can get this bad news at the very end and be extra pissed.
I think what happens in this case, see, it's my understanding, at least based on how my degree program works, because if I didn't do well on this test, they put you in a remedial math class. So you take it's just an extra waste of a semester for you. You have to add in another, you know what I mean? It's just an extra bit of classes that you don't technically need if you do well enough on the test. So you will be put in this class, but maybe it's different for undergrad work. I'm not sure. It's interesting, though, because these people, like this one lady's argument, see, for her, she's getting her degree because it's going to lead to an extra $10,000 a year. And I get that. But that speaks more to the corporatization and more to the fact that degrees are less about the challenge of learning and more about the accumulation of money, of monetary wealth, as opposed to, you know, knowledge. And so, you know, this lady's quoted as saying, is algebra a fundamental skill for life? I say, yeah, of all the mathematics that's out there, algebra is a pretty goddamn good one to know. And then after that, I think everything after algebra is pretty much where you're kind of like, okay, you're getting into loftier maths and you don't necessarily need to be taking those. But I think people who can't do a basic, simple algebra, like if you don't even know the FOIL method, you don't belong in university. I don't care who you are. And, you know, So one other thing I was going to bring up is that I guess Wayne State was in trouble back in the mid-90s or in the early 90s because they had an English proficiency test. And this just reminded me of it when you brought up that you have a lot of ESL students in your area. But in our area, the test was it says it was unsuccessfully challenged in a high profile lawsuit filed by students who claimed the test discriminated against African-Americans who earned enough credits to graduate but failed the test several times. They failed their English test. African-Americans failed their English test. Now, I know there's a joke there and I'm not going to make it. All I'm saying is that these people came up to they tried to make this into an issue about, you know, poor grammar skills or whatever it is that they weren't succeeding on. And then in the meantime, you know, I'm not trying to be racist here. What I'm trying to do, because some of my best friends are black, including former Detroit school board president Otis Mathis, who was recently sentenced to probation for fondling himself in front of a DPS school superintendent who supported this legislation to get rid of DWSU English proficiency tests. That's science fact. Otis Mathis was just recently put on probation for fondling himself in front of a public school superintendent. Imagine that scenario. That's all I wanted to lead that to. I actually had no case against the English proficiency test. I just wanted to talk about the fact that one of our school board members fondled himself.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the problem is not with the college system. The college system is receiving all of the ire of anger that should be directed at the public school, the basic system, you know, the K through 12 is really where the problem begins. And then colleges admit these students who maybe were allowed to succeed at lower levels when they shouldn't have succeeded. And then they get to college and it's like this awful wake up call. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. Here's a place that actually has definitive standards for excellence and I'm fucked. And then it's like, well, this system's broken. Well, not the college is just, it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
But I do think that colleges, because this is the reality, they need to put, you know, they need to offer programs guided specifically to help people out that got fucked by their K through 12 education.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you do have a bunch of African Americans who are put at a severe structural disadvantage and basically shit on by the entire educational system, saying, yeah, well, you know, fuck it. You came from a poor area. You're fucked. Sorry. You got to pass the exam or you're fucked, without helping them, you know, recognizing that they've already been fucked and trying to help them.
Yeah.
Succeed.
I agree. Nah, I was just pissed about that today. And I hope what comes out of this is less of a close examination of the university system and more of an examination of what precedes that. What comes before it, because yeah. I think that's what needs to be evaluated most.
All right, we'll move on to the news. News, news, news. The motherfucking
news is out. All right, so this week in news, I actually have, I just have three things that I want to talk about. One's a bit lighthearted, and two of them bring up larger topics. Now, I think in our last podcast, we talked about Netflix. But there's more news coming out on the Netflix front, and it's bad news for consumers. And I hate to have to be the bearer of this bad news, and I'm pissed that this is even coming out. But today, shares, which I don't give a fuck about, owning stocks is immoral, and you should kill yourself if you own any, which is probably some people who listen to this podcast. I apologize. But all I'm saying is right now, consumers are getting the shaft in this corporate battle over what the future of television and movies in terms of sales, not just going to a theater and seeing a movie, but DVD, like post theater sales, how that is being affected. And so what's happening right now is Netflix is in the crosshairs of all sorts of media companies right now. So like I was saying, their shares are down. I think they said close to 8% since Friday. Which isn't a huge thing, but it's still way below what Netflix usually trades for. And what's happening is there are businesses now, such as like Time Warner and Comcast, of course, which we talked about last week, who are pissed that Netflix has become the huge media conglomerate that it is. Netflix is so wildly successful because of their sort of back to the basics approach, putting your viewing habits into your own hands, which I fully support. I don't want anything fucking shoved down my throat. I want to be able to make the choices when I want to make them. And so these companies are all targeting Netflix because what they're pissed about is they think that Netflix got too big too fast and it's an out of control beast that they need to tame. In other words, Netflix made a deal a few years back with the cable network Starz, and Starz delivers pretty much, I mean, I'm not going to say they deliver all the greatest films that come out, but it's like a lot of the new releases come out. And so Netflix, I think they paid $25 million, some really small amount of money, a pittance, to have access for 2 years to the catalog, to the library of Starz Play. And in doing so, they were able to provide some pretty exclusive content for Netflix customers. So we were able to watch, you know, anytime we wanted, we could watch Hook. We could watch Donnie Darko. You name the amazing film, we had access to
it. Hey, and I like Hook, goddammit.
I don't mind it either. I actually just, in that, what's the name of that website? Give it a quick plug. What's the, Flick Chart?
Yeah, flickchart.com is Chris and my new addiction.
Yeah, Hook just beat out Troy, just so you know. An easy win, I know, but it just shows you the box office behemoths it had to go up against to win. All right, so back to the story. So these people are pissed because it's a popular and it's a profitable website. And so they're pissed because early on, these people underestimated what the market would be like for Netflix. And now that the market is fucking massive, that Netflix has cornered the market successfully, they want their comeuppance. They think that they're owed some sort of residuals off the back end of the success of Netflix, which of course isn't what they deserve. They signed contracts, they have deals, and so they are going to stick to them. But those contracts are all coming to a close, I believe this year or at the end of sometime near the first quarter of next year. So what's happening is, for those of us who have enjoyed the content that we've gotten, Netflix is either going to have to discontinue that content or pay heftily to continue streaming that for us, which means that for users, we're going to end up having to pay more for Netflix. They're essentially trying to sink Netflix because they want to be able to now form their own Netflix-like giant or partner with somebody in some way that's going to be more beneficial to them. So, you know, they're saying, you know, Starz got the shaft. They only charged $25 million for that catalog. It should have been $250 million. Things like that. They're also pissed because after a movie is released, the aftermarket for movies has been sort of experiencing the same thing that the music industry did, where the old guard is dying out. It's a dying breed, you know, although I will say it's still a much more lucrative one than the music industry. That's pretty much dead. But the aftermarket sales for DVDs has suffered because, and this is a reality for me, I used to actually go to stores and I would make impulse buys. I would go in and I would just see a movie that I hadn't seen, but I knew it was good. You know, maybe you said it was good or another friend of ours said it was a really good movie. So I'd say, fuck it, I'll buy it. Well, now I don't have to. I'll Netflix it because I pay a monthly fee anyway. I get it to my house. And even if I like it, if there's a version, if that version has special features and I liked it enough, I'll just Netflix the special features sometimes. If I loved it, though, I will go buy it. So really, it's a way for me to, you know, test the water, see what's doing out there. I like to see what movies I like, and I will go buy them. I went and saw How to Train Your Dragon in the theaters. I bought the Blu-ray when it came out because I knew it was going to be spectacular to watch on a HDTV. So really all it is it's giving the consumers more power right now anyway. To be able to say, well, I don't want to own that movie. I don't need to own that movie. If I need to get it, I'll get it on demand when I need it. And if I really love it, then you'll get my business. And that's not what they want, obviously. They want us to not only go to the movies, they want us to buy the DVD. They want us to then buy the Blu-ray. Then they want us to buy the Criterion Collection Edition. Then they want us to buy the director's cut. Then they want us to buy the fucking every other cut that there is in the world. And I'm looking at you, Blade Runner, million editions. You know, it's fucking crazy. And, I'm just, as a consumer, I'm pissed because this is another way to effectively remove the power of the consumer and instead put in place an arbitrary fucking price to pay for entertainment. And I, for one, hope that the masses, which of course this won't happen, I hope we rise up and overtake Time Warner and Comcast and fucking Sony and whoever it is, all these fucking assholes, and make it known that we don't want their shit. I think everyone should just start fucking pirating everything from this point forward. Either get it from Netflix, or even if you go through Blockbuster, whoever your subscription service is, get it from them, and fuck all these other assholes who just want to artificially impose some inflated price for their bullshit wares. I'm done with that shit.
Yeah, the sad thing is Netflix is like one of the few companies in existence that I actually think does a good job of what they're doing. You know, they don't hammer you with ads. You know, they've kept a steady pricing scheme that I think is pretty fair. They've been doing a good job of increasing content. Like, and they've just been doing it well. And now it's very clear that they are going to get just murdered by Comcast and Time Warner because we fucked ourselves by allowing them to monopolize the ISP business.
Mm-hmm.
They're now going to show what, you know, the dire price of a monopoly. Because Netflix is beholden, we're all beholden to their pricing structures for their pipes that they own. They now, you know, they can effectively squeeze Netflix out of the business by raising their costs so much that they have to raise their subscription costs so much that the consumers are going to be like, fuck this. And then maybe Comcast and Time Warner can undercut them a little bit while giving you a shittier package altogether. Yeah. And we're all going to be fucked. You're seeing the sun setting on the Netflix era.
It's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad. Yeah. And you know, and meanwhile, yeah, what we're going to get force fed is another bullshit. It's the same bullshit that they try to give you with any sort of cable thing. We're going to give you 900 channels, you know, 870 of them are bullshit channels that you don't want. Then they're going to say, you know, and for an extra, you know, what they're going to do is they're going to give you a fucking telephone line, a landline that nobody fucking wants.
Yeah, that's the only way. If you're going to want a Netflix-like service, you're going to have to buy into one of their bullshit bundles. It's going to have an awful fucking interface. It's going to have a shit ton of ads. It's going to be slow as fuck. It's going to be awful. Get ready for it. You're going to have Comcast streaming. And everyone loves Comcast On Demand, that piece of shit service.
How great is their fast forward rewind options on their on demand shit? You get two speeds, you know? It's like play and play slightly faster. That's what you get.
The thing I hate about on demand, first of all, it's slow as fuck when you're trying to navigate anything. And of course, there was never any thought to maintaining a large library. You know, Netflix innovated all that stuff. And Netflix has a good interface and interesting ways to navigate. And then on demand, while you're navigating, you have some bullshit program playing like, hey, everybody, welcome to on demand. If you
want to know how to use your controller, here's how you do.
And then it repeats every time you press the control button. It's like, hey, everybody, hey, everybody, hey, everybody. Oh, we're all fucked.
And it's all advertised. Yeah. And it's like Ryan Reynolds stars in the latest, you know, I don't care.
Get ready, people.
Yeah. Even if you watch like FearNet, it's like, you get a commercial break? I don't want a fucking commercial in any of that shit. First off, all those movies blow, and this just in, Netflix has all those shitty movies anyway on their streaming. They have every shitty horror movie, so, you know, not to attack their catalog, but a lot of their movies blow. But they still outdo Comcast. It's just, so anyway, it's bullshit, and I hope in protest, more people sign up for Netflix, and maybe even Netflix becomes its own internet service provider. What if that happened? That would be
impossible.
Amazing.
I mean, because they need the contracts with the people who really own the internet, like AT&T and Quest. You know, why is this shit privatized? I don't know.
It doesn't make sense because you know, telephone lines and shit like that, isn't that all? I mean, that's all been worked out through, I think that had to go through the, you know, those sort of antitrust legislation or, you know, the legalities of that shit to make it so that I mean, that's how most every other business is able to use different. I mean, Sprint can use AT&T's cables, you know, if you're using a landline. It doesn't matter. And anyway, it's just fucking horseshit. Let's move on to something that we both love, which is crybabies and politics. John Boehner, the new Speaker of the House. I don't know if you've seen any of this shit about him. But this motherfucker,
he's terrible.
He's one of the worst. I mean, he's not smart. He's not, he doesn't have ideas. He's not an ideas man. So, you know, he has
no charisma. He's
no. He's like a real doll, but in reverse. Like, you don't want to fuck it. You know, you don't want to sit it in the corner of your room. You don't want anything to do with it. You don't want to come inside of it lovingly.
Sit it in a corner of your room as it stares with its glassy eyes at you.
Legs spread.
Shamefully as you masturbate to Tube Galore.
So critics right now are getting on John Boehner's face, getting on John Boehner's case. You know, basically what's come out is the motherfucker's a crybaby. He's cried three times now publicly. But I don't want to actually chastise the guy. I want to have a fair analysis, to be honest. Here's where I'm pissed. John Boehner up until now, he's cried twice. The third time was sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back here, whatever that word is. Because up until now, they gave him a pass for these things, which it's like, I don't personally give a shit. But there is a whole other side to this, which is that when women in politics cry, it's perceived as a weakness. Or, to take this further, because that's a certainty. When women in politics cry, that's scrutinized. They're under a microscope. To extrapolate a bit, when liberals cry, it's a sign of weakness. When someone like John Boehner, that's the alternate pronunciation.
It is the pronunciation. It's a German name, and in the German, it'd be Boehner. And I fucking took a shitload of German.
Yeah, and this just in. Fucking, you don't hear fucking Representative Wiener.
Yeah, he owns it.
Yeah, he doesn't go, no, I'm Viner. You know, no, he's fucking Wiener.
Wait, I just made a connection here.
Uh-oh.
Do you remember that children's show with a guy named Wiener?
Mm-hmm.
He looks a lot Wiener, like Representative right? Wiener. Yeah, what the fuck?
It was Wienerville,
yeah. And that guy, that Wienerville guy, looks a lot like Representative Wiener. Are they related?
I'm wikiing it now just to see.
Mark Wiener was the guy's name.
And isn't that the name of our Wiener?
Is he?
Isn't it Representative Mark?
They're both from New York. His Wikipedia doesn't say it, though.
I think his name – or Anthony Wiener. Isn't his name Anthony Wiener?
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. I'm just going to see if – I'm Googling the two and seeing if there's anything. No, I don't see any connections here. But that's all right.
But there is – people Google Mark Wiener and Anthony Wiener. They look a lot alike.
Yeah, it's a striking resemblance. But I think it has a lot to do with them being Jews.
The Wiener genetic pool is awfully slim.
You mean it doesn't have girth and robustness?
Wiener genetic.
Or its foreskin? All right. So this is what I want to bring up, though, is the fact that John Boehner is basically what was being said up until now. The dialogue was, when a conservative does this, that's just indicative of their compassionate conservatism. So I'm pissed that there's this double standard in the country, which, I mean, it should come as no surprise, obviously. But I just want to point out the fact that up until today, this is the first time I've seen someone say, like, wait a second, guys, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? He cries over everything, apparently. And everyone hates Nancy Pelosi, but she adeptly pointed out that had she cried, that would have been the end of it. Case in point, Hillary Clinton cried one time on the campaign trail, if you remember. And even I almost fell into the trap, and I was like, that was awfully robotic of her. I mean, it just didn't seem genuine. I'm scrutinizing whether or not she has genuine tears, as if she's fucking, as if she's a cyborg, you know, and I'm trying to figure out whether or not that's oil dripping out of her eyeball. You know what I mean? It's unfair to characterize people as not being able to do that. Now, having said that, I should be erring on the side of saying, well, then, you know, if Boehner's allowed to cry, so should women and vice versa. So, you know, I should give Boehner a fucking pass here, but I'm not going to. And the reason why is because I hate Republicans. So
at least you're honest about it.
So I can't do it.
It is.
So what do you think about that shit?
It's sort of fascinating that women, you know, women politicians have to perform a certain kind of masculinity. Hence the reason why they all have short haircuts, or like with Sarah Palin, she's got to bun it up.
Yeah, or you know, she has to become the objectified version of a female.
Yeah, so they either have to perform a certain masculinity or be sexually objectified. But then the men have to be, like, delicately, like, almost feminine in a way. I can't wrap my head around why conservatives would find it acceptable for Boehner to cry.
You know, there's a stoicism that's expected, but within that stoicism, if there's some sort of a malleability that isn't capitulating to terrorism or brown people, it can be then there's a leniency granted for that.
It's like the tears of an eagle.
Yes, it's just like on 9/11. The day the eagle cried, the eagle was allowed to cry that day. So the day John Boehner was reflecting on his janitorial service and how he missed it, he was allowed to cry that day. I'm not joking. That's what he cried about. He was a fucking janitor. What a fucking tool. I just know that he's a pussy, and I wouldn't vote for someone who's not as cockstrong as as someone like, for instance, Denis Kucinich, who not only preaches peace, but does so without tears. So, you know, I just want to pose that to all the Americans who are grabbing their fucking their guns and their saggy balls right now, trying to act like they're trying to posture themselves like they're, you know, strong enough to win a war against anyone in this fucking world on their own, you know, not with our army. But
so for you would want to vote for someone that could defeat his opponent in single combat.
Yeah. Yes. I would love. See, politics, they always want to describe politics as this, you know, it's the combat arena, but it truly isn't until we somehow involve Thunderdome. And once that happens, and only once that happens, can we then really say that politics is decided on a true, you know, gridiron of sorts, some sort of an equal playing field where two men enter and one man leaves. Or women. Or both. I would like to see women in Thunderdome. I think that could be sexy, right?
with chainmail shirts and
right
mohawks
and shirtless. I would like, if I can put in a request, if I can help write the rules for Thunderdome. Two men enter, one man leaves. If women, you know, there'll be an asterisk. If these are women, they will both be topless and they will writhe on top of one another for 15 minutes before crushing their opponent.
I just love the notion of arena-like combat with people having to choose their weapons. Like, I love the idea of weapon racks and people having to, like, decide, okay, I'm going to go with the halberd. He's going with the sword and shield. Like, I have a reach advantage. He's got the
defense. There's tactics. There's tactics. But there's some sort of strategy that you need to employ, as opposed to with politics where you just run your fucking hairy maw all day and blah, 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 blah. Speaking of somebody who ran their maw, though, what about motherfucking Bernie Sanders? What a badass.
Yeah.
I don't have that as a news story, but I just want to bring that up, that asshole, I mean, in a good way, that asshole filibustered like a pro.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those rare moments in politics where someone does what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And because politics is so clearly, it's all about re-election and trying to navigate your position in order to get yourself re-elected. And you know, if politics wasn't about that, it would be a totally different world. You know, it's something like the Bush tax cuts, there would be no chance it would ever get extended, because any decent person can look at those tax cuts, any decent intelligent person can look at them and see that they're fundamentally unjust and unnecessary. But then you have only Bernie Sanders having the balls to stand up and do what's right. And it's just it's so comforting that there is at least one person.
Yeah.
You know, there's still one person that'll say, "What the fuck is this?" You know, because what really pisses me off about these tax cuts is this idea, this fucking bullshit idea that continues to exist, that somehow if you treat the rich well, that they're going to like hand out money on street corners or fly over in a gold-plated helicopter and dump hundreds on your lawn or something.
Yeah.
When you are super fucking rich, and we're talking about millionaires and billionaires, that's who this really affects. Those people could give a fucking shit. It's all about accumulating wealth. So when they get a tax cut, their fucking accountant, who's the only one who knows how much money they make, you know, these people, they have so much money it doesn't even matter at this point, because they're set forever and ever for 50 generations. When they get a tax cut, it doesn't even fucking matter to them. Their accountant just says, well, you've, you know, the bottom line is inched up this bit more. You know, that money doesn't get redistributed. It doesn't force them to do anything differently with their life. Yeah. It just accumulates more wealth for them.
Well, I got frustrated last week because you and I are both big Howard Stern fans, but he made a comment about how
But let's be clear. Howard Stern isn't smart.
Right.
He's not an intelligent person. I don't listen to Howard Stern for an intelligent comedy.
No, that's true. But I think he has the same mindset as other rich folks do, which is he said, my charitable giving is up exponentially because of these tax cuts. Well,
no, it's not.
This just in. That's a likely story, too. I mean, the likelihood that they're up exponentially is very low. They're probably up, but not very much. But keep in mind that while charitable giving is an amazing thing, especially when it comes from wealthy philanthropists, that really affects a small minority or people with a specific ailment or cause or whatever it is, a social ill, whatever it is that they need help with. Or, you know, in his case, you know, the North Shore Animal League, let's say, you know, that helps animals, not people. Well, if we get their fucking tax dollars, that boosts the middle class. That makes me give charitably. Imagine if 98% of our society was giving charitably. That would exponentially increase how much is going to charities. You know what I mean? It's like if you bring up it's that same old fucking it's the gold standard. You bring up the middle class and everything improves. You fucking idiots.
Yeah, they don't understand basic economics. And
no.
I really believe it's a fucking myth entirely. I don't think I heard some studies on NPR that said that tax cuts to the wealthy return less than what they offer, whereas tax cuts to the middle class return more economically. Yeah. Because the wealthy, when you're fucking Scrooge McDuck, getting a little bit more wealth, it doesn't change your life whatsoever. No.
You just end up building another money bin.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't understand how people don't get this. So when you're super fucking rich, taxing the shit out of those people won't affect them in any way, yet will greatly affect everyone else, while not taxing them won't affect them in any way and doesn't do shit for anyone else.
Yep, it's a lose-lose in that scenario.
Tax the rich into fucking submission. The reason why they're rich is because of all of us. They could not be rich without us. Tax the fucking shit out of them. Take the money back. God damn it, people.
Now, having said that, when I win the Mega Millions tomorrow night, I would like to recant all my statements so I can hold on to as much money as possible.
I mean, could you imagine winning the Mega Millions and worrying about your tax rate?
Like, I hear people in the hypotheticals that are, like, around work or wherever, you know, where they're like, if I won that money, you know, I think it's up to 100 and some million, let's say. It's 120 million. You're like, well, yeah, you only get 60 of that. You're like, what? Okay. If it's even the 12 million, well, you know, you only get 4. Yeah. Okay. I'll take all of it. Give me all that I'm legally allowed to have. And then give the rest away to taxation. I don't give a shit. I will deposit it and live off of it, you fucking imbeciles. You know, the rest of that doesn't really go to helping schools. I don't care where it goes after I've given it up. I have my piece, and as long as it's legit, give it away.
I think the problem, too, is that people don't understand what rich really means. That, you know, people, when they hear rich, I think they conflate rich with people making like $100,000 to $200,000 or something like that. And they believe, even though it's not true, that they'll be making that someday.
Right.
And it is statistically proven that most people will never reach that kind of income. And then fucking median income is $45,000.
Yeah. You have almost a 0% chance of transcending your own socioeconomic class.
Yeah. And we're the first generation, which is almost guaranteed not to do better than our parents. So fucking chew on that shit. But, when we're talking about taxing the rich, we're talking about the millionaires and billionaires who own, even though they're this tiny fraction of the population, they own mass amounts of wealth. So that's who we're focused on. And that's who the Bush tax cuts really affect the most. Those tax cuts generate more wealth for these people who are hoarding it in incredibly profound ways. And so your fucking pickup, your suburban driving yokel who gets pissed at the idea of taxing rich people doesn't understand who the target really is of those taxes. It's the Howard Sterns of the world who just signs a $400 million fucking contract, who I don't want to ever hear bitching about taxes when you've got like $900 million, you dickhead.
You
like,
literally have zero to ever worry about. Unless you get involved in a Bernie Madoff-esque Ponzi scheme, you're fine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
God, dude,
I don't know.
You got me all fired the fuck up.
I know. And meanwhile, there are billionaires and millionaires who are trying to get this shit. God, there's an ad on this page. I'm trying so hard to soldier through it. There's 89 millionaires who petitioned Obama to allow the tax cuts of incomes greater than $1 million to expire this year. And among those, I think I might have read this last week, but it was like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. You know, the people who's for the next 90 generations of their family will never need to worry about a fucking thing. Even in the event of a Fallout 3-esque apocalypse, they will still have enough to buy bottle caps in the new wastelands.
Yeah, and I think because the theme of the All Caps podcast is that people are stupid. And if you start to recognize this fact that people are stupid, everything begins to make sense. When you have a lot of wealth, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett-esque wealth, it exponentially increases with every year. You know, just throwing it into their basic fund accounts, it just piles and piles on top of each other. That's why why the Rockefellers or the Kennedys or whoever the fuck are just rich forever. It just, you know, and they can create a foundation that's rich forever. People don't realize this, I don't think, where if you have this sort of wealth, there's no threat to it ever being taken down, really, or reduced to zero, or you losing it all. This isn't like MC Hammer or something. You know, this is true wealth that is damn near permanent. So, you know, people like Gates and Buffett realize this. They're like, tax the fuck out of me. I don't care.
Yeah.
You cannot possibly dent this, you know.
I actually blame a lot of our current perception of wealth I'll put all of the onus on Robin Leach and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous from the mid 80s to early 90s, because that's where everyone thinks that's what fame, fortune, and you know whatever it was that he always said. I don't remember what his catchphrase was, but he champagne wishes and caviar dreams, blah, 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 fucking crikey, whatever. The motherfucker made everyone think that you have to own a yacht and all this other shit. And, you know, meanwhile, some of the people that he was putting on that show didn't deserve to be considered part of that echelon. But now everyone has this perception that, you know, you could be this rich too, and it's just not true.
And that depiction of rich is the MC Hammer wealth, you know, this precarious kind of quickly gained and quickly lost sort of richness that does not compare to the financial the financially wealthy and the people who own, you know, resources and companies and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where that sort of wealth is planned out and plotted and managed meticulously. You know?
These people don't just have liquid wealth. I mean, they have a shit ton of liquid wealth, but they have investments. And they, you know, most of their money is tied up in investments, but a lot of it is tied up so intrinsically in the actual U.S. economy that this is why this pulls so much weight in Congress. It's like to get these people riled up, you know, the real wealth in the country, this wealthy 2%, the upper crust, you know, to really rile them up. That's where, you know, that's why they have so much fucking leverage, because they own debt that the country has, you know, shit like that. It's just paying off in spades. They have every influence ever needed, political connections, corporate connections, and, you know, they could have you and I murdered in a second.
Yeah, and the U.S. Treasury has been and continues to be run by former financial industry wizards. I mean, so it's like, so when they, you know, basically destroy an entire generation of people through the housing crisis by both manufacturing it and then bailing themselves out about it from it. It's just, it's profound that people, there's no revolution. I mean, to me, this is revolution worthy. This is get in the streets and overthrow shit worthy. What has happened to all of us? People are struggling. The people don't have jobs. People's, they've lost their houses. They can't get health insurance. While that top 2 to 3% every year is getting record increases in salary and wealth.
Yep.
It's like, do the math, people. You're all being fucked.
Well, I think we should go on to culture because we could go on for another hour on this topic, I think. All and right. We're already an hour into this shit. In the culture vulture world, I only like real friends. This game's no EverQuest. I only fly first class. I think that movie ruined our opinions. That album dropped like poop. God will be our word. That writer's such a douche. George Lucas fucked my youth. Back with culture. This week, I want to review one of my most anticipated releases of the what's called Oscar season, essentially, this period from about October until the end of December, early January, where all of the big Oscar contenders essentially get released. Because apparently Hollywood has a short-ass memory, which it's really fucking strange in this way. And that's just how it's done. Well, one of the biggest releases, in my opinion, of the Oscar season is Black Swan, by director Darren Aronofsky, a show favorite who has done Pi, Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, The Wrestler. Also, in recent news segments, we discussed how he is now the Wolverine director. So Black Swan stars Natalie Portman, Mila Kunis, who is from That 70s Show fame, Vincent Cassell, who's this guy that I recognize his face. I imagine viewers would recognize his face, but you can't really pin a movie on him. And I was looking through his IMDb, and I don't know that I've ever seen a movie that he's in. I guess he was in Irreversible, which I'm sure no one's seen. I saw that. I remember him, and I don't know why this is the one thing I remember him from, but Brotherhood of the Wolf. I do remember seeing him in that in the theater in that movie. So,
Barbara Hershey is in it. Winona Ryder has a small role. So this is a tough movie to discuss because I don't want to give much away because I think it's a good movie to not know much about when you go into it. But essentially, Natalie Portman is an up-and-coming ballerina in the New York scene. And Vincent Cassell plays, the director of the New York Ballet, one of the most famous directors of ballet productions in the world. And Winona Ryder is the former star ballerina that's retiring. And now Vincent Cassell has... he wants to replace her with his new starlet, in a way. And Natalie Portman is competing for this opportunity, and Mila Kunis is as well. And the production that they're competing to star in is Swan Lake, which is probably the most popular ballet production. And even if you don't really know when I say that, you probably are familiar with it in some way. Because it's,
I think
just
they did ubiquitous. It on Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, they very well may have. I mean, it's what you identify just like the Nutcracker with ballet in a way. So the film then is about people wanting to be in the production Swan Lake, but then the film becomes itself a production of Swan Lake. Which is, I haven't seen someone pull that off in this way where the and the Totally Rad Show guys put it this way. It's like a Charlie Kaufman movie in that it's very meta, where it starts to unravel on itself, and it's a narrative within a narrative within a narrative sort of situation. And it's executed much more subtly than in a Charlie Kaufman movie, I think, which is to its advantage, because it's more accessible in that sense. Like you might not even notice that this is taking place while it's happening.
Sort of what is that movie that Synecdoche? You remember that one?
Yeah, Synecdoche, New York with Felix Kaufman. Yeah, so it's very similar to that, but it structurally. But then the movie is a psychological thriller with some horror elements in it as well, which is a different style than I'm used to from him. He's always been very intense, but he has some jump scares in this film and that kind of thing, which are interesting to see him try out. And it is an incredibly intense, visceral film. There's a lot of bodily injury, which I think is important to some of the key themes of the story. It deals a lot with the notion of celebrity, artistic creation, and beauty, and the costs of those things. So part of this is the bodily pain of those processes, and it really manipulates you on that level, where people were in the film cringing during it. I mean, it really affects you to the point where you're not quite sure if you can watch what's happening.
Sort of like how he did when we went and saw Requiem for a Dream. Is it that sort of cringing? Like people?
Yeah, but to the next level in a way.
Oh, man.
I think Natalie Portman, who I've always had a troubled relationship with because she's very hit and miss. I think she needs a good director in a way. And the best example of this is the Star Wars movies. Yeah. You know, where someone like Ewan McGregor could kind of navigate it by himself because Lucas can't direct. Natalie Portman got lost in that movie and was basically a mannequin. But in this movie, she's in really capable hands. Of course, Aronofsky put Mickey Rourke back on the map. And in this movie, there's a lot of buzz. Natalie Portman will most likely get nominated for Best Actress. And I think it's deserved, even though this is a role where she's not likable, which is really interesting. She's this sort of vulnerable, prissy girl who, throughout the process of the movie, transforms in a way. But really well acted, and Vincent Cassell is an excellent dirtbag in this film. And I'm excited to see what he does after this. I can't really talk that much about it because there's twists and weird shit that happens, and it's best just experienced. I think I couldn't stop while I was watching the movie intellectualizing it. It interrogates patriarchy and beauty in a really interesting way, and in such an intellectually astute way that few other films really achieve. Like, Aronofsky makes movies that people want to see, but also, if you're willing, there's a lot to think about in them. And I had problems with The Wrestler because I thought it was too heavy-handed and obvious. This movie's not. This movie is, I think, a better movie than The Wrestler in a lot of ways. I would highly recommend people go to see it. But that being said, by the end of it, it's not a movie that I'd want to experience again. But it's an experience that I loved going through. So in that sense, I've got to give it a B. Even though it's worth more than a B as a film-going experience. So highly recommended. But if you don't like film art, you're going to fucking hate this movie. So that's the caveat.
So what do you give it? What's your full grade?
I give it a B. But
okay.
With that idea that I think it's smart and fascinating, but I could also see people absolutely hating it.
Well, I think the big thing that listeners really want to know about is number one, is there any titty? Number two, is there fur burgerage?
There is no titty.
But
there is makeout scenes, okay. And there is masturbatory scenes, a couple of them.
But not with dudes, right? Intense. Like girls doing that.
Yeah, girls. And Natalie Portman, I think I've mentioned this before. She's too beautiful. And it bothers me.
What are you, the kid from fucking American Beauty?
I don't find her attractive.
Me neither. I'm not really that attractive.
Because she's perfect. It's bizarre in this way.
Well, she's a great looking gal, but I'm not a. She's not for me. I think Mila Kunis is hot. I think she's hot.
But this film, I mean, those two are perfectly cast in that way, in that Natalie Portman's character is meant to be this sort of perfect form, you know? So she's a perfect role. And Mila Kunis is kind of like the wrong side of the tracks girl. So it fits in that way. But I mean, it's just Natalie Portman is just this bizarre visage to me. Like I have a hard time watching her because she's too perfect. It's like, you know, and I don't think there's an equivalent really among male actors. Because male actors are often handsome because they have some sort of rugged charm.
Right. I think what I was going to say is, I think one of the only directors who ever utilized her, that aspect of her, was Wes Anderson when he put her in the Hotel Chevalier.
Yeah.
The sort of prequel to the Darjeeling Limited, which I just watched again, and I have to say I kind of liked it. It's sort of like how it was with The Life Aquatic. I hated it in the theaters. I hated the Darjeeling Limited in the theaters. I watched it over Thanksgiving, and I kind of liked it. I'm not saying it's a great movie it's my favorite thing ever, but I liked it. But more to the point, though, he utilized Natalie Portman in such a way as to make her that very beautiful, almost unobtainable beauty, and the sort of thing that, you know, men, sort of like a siren, you know, that it's just spoke about in myths but never really actualized. But I'm actually really curious about Mila Kunis, because, or however you say her name, because she's been in a swath of shitty films. Like, she was in American Psycho 2. You can catch that on your fucking Comcast on demand. she was in that movie, and it was horrible. And she's just been in all these horrible things. Now, she's also found a lot of success as a voice actor in Family Guy. But so this is almost interesting to me, because I almost thought I had relegated her to being this sort of in a post That 70s Show funk, where she's not great as being in the fore, but, you know, as a voice actor, she's doing well, and she can do B movies. But this is clearly not a B movie. Does she hold her own? And furthermore, do you foresee future work for her, or is this sort of a one-off kind of role?
I think she fits this role well, and I think anyone that is under the guidance of Aronofsky doesn't fail. I think he, right. He seems to be really good with actors. But I get the impression she's just being herself in every movie. Natalie Portman is very transformative here. Mm-hmm. She's got all this vulnerability, and she's really bizarre and annoying in a way that she hasn't been in other films. But Mila Kunis, I think in every film, she's that same sort of spunky, fast talking sort of chick, you know?
Right.
And so it works for this film. I don't think she has range to succeed beyond that. I just don't. I don't see it happening.
But there's no Mila Kunis boobies or for
murders. She's always very, very well broad.
God.
It's very obvious that it was like stipulated in her contract, I think.
clearly Aronofsky has not done his job as a director, and I will therefore boycott this movie until the studio releases a director's cut or unedited, whatever, unrated version is what I want to say.
All right, we'll be back with Wildcard. Wild card, but I do want to ask people, because this question is kind of plaguing me as I just took a piss during the break. If you can think of a male actor who's like Natalie Portman in that he's so good looking, it's almost off-putting. I'd like to hear from you if you post on a.
What about Orlando Bloom? That just came to mind because
He's got a big nose and.
Okay.
You know, I don't think he's – the thing about Natalie Portman is her face is – if a computer was to generate a composite of models or something and proportions, that's what it would be. Like I'm trying to think of a male actor who's like that. So if you can think of that, email us at allcapspodcast@gmail.com. I'd be interested to hear what people think. Let's go on to Wildcard, which is our recurring – set of games, humorous in nature, that we enjoy playing. There's been a time trial I've been sitting on that I'd like to do. And the time trial is where one of us comes up with a topic. We set the timer for 10 minutes and we have a set 10 minutes to talk about that topic or anything that comes to mind in relation to that topic. And I've got the timer set for 10 minutes. And the topic I want to discuss is something I think a lot of our audience could relate to because it's a form of entertainment in childhood that most young boys and maybe some young girls obsess over for a certain period of time and then usually jettison it.
Genitalia.
No, I'm still obsessed. Oh. And that topic is professional wrestling.
Ooh, wow. Well, go ahead. Do you want to start or do you want me to just start going crazy?
The thing, here's what set me off about professional wrestling is I was thinking about how fucking bizarre it was. When my period of professional wrestling fandom was probably the mid-80s to early 90s. And then once again in maybe the mid to late 90s, with a little break in between there, then it ended. And I was thinking about how when I was a kid, though, how bizarre some of the wrestlers were. And the ones in particular I thought about were the Bushwhackers and how these guys would wear urban camouflage and tank tops. And their gimmick was
out.
Yeah, they were hickish brothers who would march out and eat something and then lick each other's heads.
Yeah, and they were toothless. It was just this disgusting.
How do you even come up with that concept? But I was thinking about how brilliant wrestling was and that wrestling, you know, a lot of people say it's a soap opera, but wrestling is also a lot like queer camp. You know, like John Waters movies or something where shit is just out of – it's like masculinity – distorted into this grotesque monstrosity in some way.
Absolutely.
That almost parodies itself. And I know a lot of people realize that wrestling is homoerotic, but when you really think about it, it is all about homoeroticism.
We think about the fact that the wrestlers people tend to attach themselves to are the ones that are the least desirable. Now, there are a few exceptions. For instance, somebody like Mankind. I can't remember his real name now.
Mick Foley.
Yeah, Mick Foley. People like him, he's sort of an anti-hero. So when his story arc called for him to be a hero, people attach themselves to it for the opposite reason people normally attach themselves to the wrestling stars, which is that their body is perfect. Their face is chiseled. They have a storyline that represents the arc of other people's interests. You know, so these things become congruent with what people think is perfection in a way.
I remember being a kid and liking certain wrestlers because they were really cut.
Yeah, yeah.
Like ravishing Rick Rude.
Right. Certain muscular features made people and on the opposite end, people who were flimsy or you know, they just didn't have the bulk, they were usually shunned in some way. They just weren't quite the same. So you'd see a guy come out who's totally ripped and that was one of the main criteria for why you liked that person.
Because, I mean, then they have to be strong, right?
And it's almost like how you choose a relationship. It always starts on a purely physical, is this person appealing to me level? And then you dig deeper to figure out if you like them. Now, so if somebody turned heel, that's a wrestling term. So if somebody turned heel and became, you know, a bad guy, sometimes you wouldn't jump ship right away because maybe it was like you still found that there were certain perfections that you liked about them that wasn't enough to keep you from liking them anymore. You know,
now I'm thinking about there's this moment in every wrestler's career when they first have to be introduced, and it would be like on a Sunday morning program. Yeah. They would get an early match or something.
Yeah.
And it was like this tentative moment when they, you know, they emerge from backstage with their music, and it's as if they are a tropical bird in Peru or something, first emerging and like peacocking for everybody, for all the young men in the audience to try and gain their attraction in a way.
Right.
Well, I'm having this major realization here.
Well, you know, this is sort of getting off that topic, but think one of the coolest things too is I used to actually love the early matches because, you know, they were always the prelude to the main event, and the main event was always every episode, every week there was a main event, you know, on the Saturday or Sunday, whatever, I think it was Saturday, whatever the WWF had on the weekend day. And that so leading up to that main event, though, there was always the jobber match, which is where some guy came out to prove himself either for the first time or whatever against the Brooklyn Brawler. Well, you know,
that guy lost probably 300,000 matches. He, which is where that ripped up t-shirt. He looked like someone's fucking dad that got that's unemployed.
Yeah. And he was fucking awesome. And the thing is, people like him or Barry Horowitz, wasn't that the guy who used to pat himself on the back?
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that him? Yeah. Okay. People like
they looked and their names sounded like they were orthodontists.
Yeah. But these guys, Lenny Poffo, these guys were...
And the match was never in question.
Right. I mean, no, you knew who was going to lose. Every so often, though, this is what had you going, though. I swear to God, every so often, one of the choppers would win.
It was this mythical event. When it would happen, you were like unsure if you were even seeing what you were seeing.
1-2-3 Kid, I think he was a jobber before he became famous. Yeah. But like, What's funny about it, though, is if you talk to the professionals, the guys who actually get, like, famous, they talk about these guys. I've seen it because I've watched a lot of shit on YouTube about this stuff. They'll talk about guys like the Brooklyn Brawler, like, and they just say, like, these are some of the best fucking wrestlers that ever came to the sport, because they're the kind of guys who they take the hits, they take a beating, and they're, you know, they know what their role is, I guess, but at the same time, they're good. They're fucking great at what they do. Like, it takes a lot more, I think, to be a jobber than it does to come up with some fucking bullshit, completely discombobulated wrestling move that is supposed to be, like, powerful, you know, like a big leg, you know, some bullshit like that.
Hulk Hogan's big leg is the ultimate example of that.
What's your favorite end move?
Fuck, that's a good question. I really, God, there's a bunch of them. The figure four.
Oh, the figure four leg lock.
Razor Ramon's Razor's Edge.
Loved it.
I can't remember him. I wish I'd thought about this beforehand.
I think I'm trying to think of
the sharpshooter, Bret Hart's.
Yep. The sharpshooter was always a favorite. See, the ones that are the best are the ones that when they're about to happen, there's a buildup to them, you know? So for instance, when the Ultimate Warrior, if I remember correctly, he did the thing where he ran between the, like, from rope to rope and then did a body splash, I think.
Yeah.
In the middle of the ring, Randy Savage did an elbow from the top ropes. That was kind of bullshit. But like, you know, the best part about those was the build up to them.
And that also brings, see, that brings up a whole other thing, which is the whole acting portion of it, where where they would fucking, the guy who's supposed to win, you know, Hogan or whoever it is like in what you would consider to be an irreversible lock, you know, some sort of a headlock, or, you know, he's in the sharpshooter and they reverse the move. And the other guy's like looking at the audience like, no, this can't be happening. And meanwhile, the other guy's gaining energy from the audience getting all pumped up. And so he overcomes the what was considered to be an unassailable move. And now he reverses it. And, it gets the crowd on his side. And it's a quick 1-2-3 pin. It's all very, very, it's all very scripted.
You know what? One thing that they got rid of in wrestling that was awesome were the interviews, the build-ups, where they would just have like Mean Gene interview two people, right. and like it was clear the wrestlers had like a bucket of water dumped on them before they would do the interview, and then they would just go in there, and it was clear that there was like no script. That's what I loved about it, and their characters would just explode, and they would turn into the most grotesque like exaggerations of who they were. Like Macho Man would just be like, his fingers would be gesturing and crumpling up, and he'd just be like, oh yeah.
My favorite interview of all time, and friend of the show Eric might agree with this because I know we laughed at this for fucking ever. It was right after the movie No Holds Barred came out. Zeus became Michael Tiny Little or whatever his name was. Yeah. Zeus comes onto the scene, and he was going to face off against Hulk Hogan and Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
One of the best gimmicks ever.
Yeah,
those fucking hedge clippers.
And so. Zeus is addressing them in one of these sort of I don't know what you want to call it, the talk up or whatever it is. And he goes, Hulk Hogan and Beefcake Barber. And we couldn't stop laughing because he didn't say Brutus the Barber Beefcake. He said Beefcake Barber. It's just fucking hilarious.
Do you remember when Ultimate Warrior got the hex put on him by Papa Shango?
Papa Shango.
And ended up puking all over his... I remember that moment happening when I was a kid and thinking, you know, I'm eight or something, and I'm thinking, they've just gone too far. He's fucking puking, and he was like spitting up oatmeal all over himself. And I'm like, really, guys? You think I'm supposed to believe this?
Well, okay, so... In that instance, that reminds me, what was your parents' view of wrestling? Because for us, it was actually off limits. We weren't supposed to watch it. And then
my parents didn't care at all. My dad would take us to matches. I'd go to live matches, which were a whole nother experience because, you know, there would be the show and the big matches, but then these live tours were just sort of, I don't know that you can compare it to any other art form where it's like fan fiction in a way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It is.
It's off the map. And one time I went to a live match and one of the refs clearly fucked up a match for, I don't even remember what star it was. And as they were going back behind the curtain, my seats were positioned there and the wrestler began yelling at and attacking the ref, and it was clearly not on script, and it blew my mind. Like, those tours, there needs to be a documentary about what the fuck happened on those tours with those like the amount of coke that was done before. Yeah.
And what about
this? It's been 10 minutes.
No way.
Yes.
Okay, well, okay, we have to
last
do a part
comment
two.
Last comment.
Okay, well, I have so many things I want to comment about, like things about WrestleMania, SummerSlam, all of the events that they had surrounding it that were an annual thing, like it would chart your course throughout the fucking calendar year, but what I was going to say is one of the things that I hated was that they eventually dissolved the idea of managers, so people like Miss Elizabeth or Bobby the Brain Heenan or Mr. Fuji or... Slick Rick, you know, these people were all they were all sort of taken out of the game, and that pissed me off.
The only point for the manager was they were a device to use at ringside to change up the outcomes of matches. That's their only purpose.
Right, yeah, they would do something devious, and that would polarize, that would make the audience pissed, and then and then the audience is screaming, and then the ref doesn't know what happened.
Yeah. It's so funny to think about the idea of the manager, because within the fiction of wrestling, they have no purpose.
Yeah.
You know, they're not doing, they're not managing or training, they don't do anything. They just they're just there to pull someone's shoe at the side of the ring.
We clearly need to devote more time to this, because we have, I have so much more to talk. We didn't even get to talk about the second incarnation in our lives, which was when the NWO came about.
Yeah.
And how within our school, we were ostracized initially because everyone said that wrestling was for gays and stuff. And then all of a sudden it was usurped by the quote unquote cool kids who then got barbed wire tattoos, which I'm sure they regret at this point in their lives. And how they basically took it over from us and then began to still try to act like we hadn't discovered it. Like, we weren't there the first night when the NWO crossed over into WCW. You know, fuck that. I want to talk about that shit. So next, one of these time trials, we're going to do that. Maybe even at the special podcast event, we'll have a second to do it. Who knows? We'll
see. Don't forget about the live all-caps show, a.k.a. the Gathering of the All-Capsians, December 23rd in the Detroit area. Email allcapspodcast@gmail.com for details. Someone's going to get to do the show intro. Someone's going to get put in a hot seat. It should be a good time. We'll hang out afterwards. Sign boobs and that kind of thing. www.allcapspodcast.com. Go to iTunes. Subscribe. Post a written review. We appreciate it. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/allcapspodcast.
I don't know what else to say to these assholes. If they didn't already leave after my racist comments about Wayne Stanky. They weren't racist, people. I was trying to get to this funny point about a guy exposing me, so stop getting yourself into a tizzy.
I think we'll have one more show, probably before the live show.
Okay.
Yeah. So look forward to that. Bye. Things would be different if you were in my place. This argument would change. Feel like I'm in second grade. She really meant nothing. I was a drunk and an idiot. Now I'm full of shame. And I don't even know her name. Oh yeah, it was Lisa. We've all been and watch it blow over. You can't keep searching, there's nothing to find.